Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So I want you to imagine, just for a moment, that you are observing this perfectly built, highly advanced microscopic machine.
Right, something super intricate.
Exactly. And this machine is actually a sensory cell sitting deep inside your inner ear. Its entire purpose, and its sole reason for existing, is to flawlessly convert the mechanical vibrations of sound into electrical signals.
Signals that your brain can actually understand, yeah.
Yeah, whether that's your favorite song or just, you know, a passing siren. And for the first couple of weeks of its existence, it is building itself beautifully. The parts are assembling, the sensors are functioning, it's all going great.
It looks like a total success story.
But then, just as this magnificent machine is fully assembled and it's finally ready to process the beautiful complexity of actual sound, it just mysteriously triggers its own self-destruct sequence.
It's wild. It initiates this process of total cellular dismantling. All that incredible developmental potential is just erased right when it's supposed to start working.
It is incredibly tragic, honestly, at a cellular level. It's like, imagine you're building a massive new house during a severe years-long drought.
Right, so water is scarce.
Exactly. Because there's barely any water around, you decide, hey, let's install a heavily undersized drainage system to save resources. And the house looks fantastic. But then the drought ends.
Yeah, the rain finally comes.
Oh, the rainy season arrives with a vengeance. The torrential downpours start, and because your gutters and drains are woefully inadequate, the house instantly floods and the foundation collapses.
Yeah.
It really makes you ask, what really happens when the microscopic cellular machinery in our ears gets the wrong signals during development?
That is the exact biological mystery we are tackling in this deep dive, because we are looking at a biological system that calibrates itself based on incomplete environmental information.
Which ultimately dooms it, right?
Exactly. It dooms it when that environment drastically changes later on.
Well, today we celebrate the work of Amanda Bryn Rolseth, Marilyn Berg, Dakota L. Conrad, Benjamin K. Augusta, and Robert Fetty Place at the University of Wisconsin, who have advanced our understanding of inner ear calcium regulation and the mechanisms of deafness.
To really understand this microscopic crime scene, I guess, you need to understand how hearing actually works for you on a mechanical level. So inside your cochlea, you have these specialized auditory hair cells.
And they aren't literal hair.
Right. No, they are crowned with these tiny microscopic bristles called stereocilia. So think of your own ears right now. If a dog barks in the distance, that sound wave enters your ear canal and physically bends these stereocilia.
It's kind of like a field of tall grass blowing in the wind.
That's a perfect way to picture it. And at the microscopic tips of this grass, there are these tiny trap doors. We call these the mechano-electrical transducer channels, or MET channels for short.
MET channels, got it.
Yeah, and the core component forming the actual pore, like the doorway of this channel, is a protein called TMC1. When the sound bends the stereocilia, the physical tension literally pulls the TMC1 channels open.
It's a mechanical action.
Entirely mechanical. And that opening allows charged ions, specifically calcium and potassium, to just rush into the cell. That sudden rush of positively charged ions is the electrical spark that travels to your brain to say, you know, hey, a dog just barked.
Okay, so TMC1 is the gatekeeper here.
Yeah.
And we know from previous research that mutations in the gene that makes this TMC1 protein, well, they cause these hair cells to die off.
Right, a process called apoptosis.
Apoptosis, yeah. And that leads to profound deafness in mice by postnatal day 21, which is about 3 weeks after they're born.
But the timeline of that cell death, that's what puzzled everyone, because if you look at these mutant mice really early on, say around postnatal day 6, those mutant TMC1 channels actually work mechanically.
Right, really, they still work.
Yeah. They open and close in response to physical movement, just like normal, healthy channels.
Wait, I'm stuck on this timeline then. Because if the channels are supposedly the source of the mutation, but they are mechanically opening and closing just fine at day 6, why aren't the cells dying at day 6? Or are they just, I don't know, taking 2 weeks to accumulate a toxic buildup, or is something else entirely going wrong?
Well, they aren't dying at day 6 because the mutation isn't breaking the physical door hinge, so to speak. the door is open, but they have a fatal flaw. They have a heavily diminished ability to let calcium into the cell.
Ah, okay.
So the calcium just isn't getting through at the normal rate. And that raises a massive red flag for researchers. Because if the channels are basically functioning early on, but just letting in a bit less calcium, why did the cells suddenly execute a self-destruct sequence 2 weeks later?
Okay, let's unpack this, because my intuition is screaming that we have a contradiction here. If calcium is rushing in normally, the cell has to pump it back out, right?
Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, it becomes toxic.
Right. And we know the heavy-duty sump pump responsible for bailing calcium out of the stereocilia is a protein called PMCA2. So if the TMC1 mutation means that less calcium is entering the cell early on in a mouse's life, why on earth is that toxic?
It seems backwards, doesn't it?
It totally does. Shouldn't a smaller amount of calcium flooding the cell be like way easier for those PMCA2 pumps to manage? Why would a light trickle of calcium trigger a catastrophic self-destruct later?
Right. Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to remember that biological systems are deeply economical. The cell doesn't want to spend precious energy building massive arrays of these heavy-duty PMCA2 pumps if it doesn't think it needs them.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, so the researchers hypothesized that the early lack of calcium, that light trickle, was actually tricking the cell into fundamentally changing its long-term infrastructure.
Wow. But, you know, hypothesizing that a cell is making infrastructure changes based on an early drought is one thing. Actually proving it requires looking inside a living microscopic hair cell to count invisible pumps without destroying the whole system. How did they even pull that off?
The physical difficulty of what they did really cannot be overstated. First, they needed the right model. They bred mouse models with very specific TMC1 point mutations. But crucially, they bred them on a TMC2 knockout background.
Meaning they got rid of the backup system.
Exactly. They completely removed the backup TMC2 protein so they could purely isolate exactly what the mutated TMC1 protein was doing. No interference whatsoever.
Got it. So they isolate the bad protein. But how do they actually measure that tiny trickle of calcium?
Well, to measure the electrical currents, they use a technique called patch clamping. You take a microscopic glass pipette, which, by the way, is significantly smaller than a human hair, and under a microscope, you have to maneuver this tiny glass tube and gently seal it against the delicate membrane of a single isolated outer hair cell.
That sounds incredibly stressful. One wrong twitch and you rupture the cell entirely, right?
Oh, yeah. But if you get the seal perfect, you can measure the incredibly tiny electrical currents flowing through those single TMC1 channels.
But they didn't just measure the electricity, did they? They literally wanted to watch the calcium entering the cell in real time.
They did. And for that, they used a highly specialized fluorescent dye called Fluo4FF.
Fluo4FF.
Yeah. They loaded this dye into that microscopic patch pipette. And as the dye seeps into the cell's cytoplasm, it remains completely dark. It only activates and lights up the exact moment it physically binds to a calcium ion.
Oh, wow, that's brilliant.
It really is. By coupling this with high-resolution confocal microscopy, they could mechanically stimulate the hair bundle, open those defective channels, and literally watch the stereocilia glow.
Just to quantify exactly how much calcium was making it inside.
Exactly.
And what they captured with these tools brings us to their first major finding, the sliding scale of calcium correlation. Because they discovered that the exact amount of calcium coming into the cell dictates exactly how many of those PMCA2 heavy-duty pumps the cell decides to build.
Yeah, it is a beautifully direct linear relationship. They looked at a wide range of different TMCO mutations and they mapped out this perfect sliding scale.
So how drastic was the drop-off?
Well, if a mild mutation only dropped the calcium flow by a third, so down to 67% of normal, the cell only removed about a third of its pumps. But in the most severe mutants, where calcium flow choked down to almost nothing, just 8% of normal, the cell basically stripped the membrane bare of pumps to match that 8% trickle.
A cell is literally looking at the low calcium levels and saying, hey, there's a drought. We don't need all these sump pumps. Stop building them.
What's fascinating here is that the researchers didn't just accept that the genetic mutation caused the missing pumps. They wanted to prove that the physical lack of calcium itself was the direct mechanical foreman on the construction site.
Right, because it could just be some weird side effect of the mutant gene itself, you know, completely unrelated to the calcium.
Exactly. So, they decided to chemically simulate the drought in perfectly healthy, non-mutated cells to see if they would behave the same way.
How do you simulate a drought in a healthy cell?
They took normal cochlear cultures and basically bathed them in a fluid with artificially low calcium. they also ran a parallel experiment using a chemical blocker called tubocurin. Yeah. Tubocurin physically plugs up about half of the normal MET channels, so it artificially restricts the calcium flow even when the fluid around the cell is totally normal.
Okay, so they essentially starved healthy cells of calcium.
Yes. And in both cases, just by starving the healthy cells of calcium for a single hour, the number of PMCA2 pumps plunged.
Wow.
Yeah, it proved unequivocally that calcium is the chemical signal telling the cell how many pumps to install.
Wait, a single hour? How is a cell physically adding or removing heavy-duty structural pumps from its surface that fast? That seems crazy.
Well, when the researchers looked through advanced transmission electron microscopes at the area just below the cell surface, the area abneural to the hair bundle, they didn't see a static wall. They found clusters of tiny 80 nanometer vesicles.
Just tiny bubbles, basically.
Think of these vesicles as little membrane bubbles, yeah, packed tightly together just beneath the surface.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because those little 80 nanometer bubbles are packed full of spare PMCA2 pumps.
Yeah.
You can kind of think of these vesicles like a highly trained pit crew at a racetrack.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Yeah, and the pumps are the fresh tires. So early in the mouse's life, during its first week, the cell is constantly monitoring the calcium. If a sudden burst of calcium comes in, the cell signals the pit crew. The vesicles fuse with the surface membrane, instantly slapping new pumps onto the stereocilia.
And the reverse is absolutely true. When the calcium levels drop, the pit crew immediately pulls those pumps back off the track.
Could pack them up.
Yeah. The cell reabsorbs them through a process called endocytosis, packing them back into the vesicles in the garage, so to speak. And to verify this dynamic swabbing process, the researchers applied a drug called Pit Stop 2.
Okay, that is an incredibly on-the-nose name for a drug blocking our pit crew.
I know, it perfectly describes the mechanism. Pit Stop 2 specifically blocks endocytosis. It paralyzes the pit crew so they can't pull the pumps back inside the cell.
And what happened when they used it?
When they applied it, the PMCA2 density plummeted. This proved that during this early developmental window, the pumps aren't permanent fixtures at all. They are incredibly dynamic, constantly turning over at remarkable speeds, entirely dependent on the environmental calcium to dictate their numbers.
So we have a highly dynamic, adaptable system. But as we know from the hook of this deep dive, the system ultimately fails. The house floods and collapses. And the reason it fails is because this dynamic adaptability actually has an expiration date.
Right. As the mouse ages past its first week, that rapid-fire swapping of pumps begins to slow down. And this slowdown is driven by the delayed arrival of an accessory protein called neuroplastin, or NPTN.
Right. The researchers noticed that NPTN development parallels the PMCA2 pumps, but it arrives at the stereocilia about 2 days after the pumps do. And instead of acting as a pump itself, NPTN acts like, well, like a molecular cement.
That's exactly it. Once NPTN binds to a PMCA2 pump, it stabilizes it in the membrane. It basically takes that pump away from the pit crew, removes it from that fast-swapping vesicle cycle, and just bolts it down permanently.
And the researchers even uncovered the exact chemical requirement for this cement to cure. They found this anchoring relies on a specific membrane lipid called PODINANS45P2.
Which is quite a mouthful.
It is. But you can really just think of this lipid as the chemical primer painted on the cell membrane that allows the neuroplastin cement to actually stick.
And to test that, they used a drug called PAO to block the cell from synthesizing that specific lipid primer. Without the primer, the neuroplastin couldn't anchor the pumps anymore, and the PMCA2 pump density crashed.
So the timeline of this anchoring is the critical element. By postnatal day 11, the neuroplastin has arrived in full force. The primer is set, the cement is cured, and it has anchored all the available pumps into place.
From day 11 onward, the researchers found that the PMCA2 density becomes completely insensitive to changes in calcium. The pit crew is basically fired. The dynamic developmental window permanently closes.
I really want to make sure we truly grasp the tragedy of this. The cell is making permanent, irreversible infrastructure decisions based entirely on temporary childhood data.
Childhood data, exactly.
During its first week, the mutant cell experiences a massive calcium drought because its TMC1 channels are defective. It assumes, logically, this is how the environment will always be. So it builds a tiny, undersized drainage system, and at day 11, it pours the concrete. It locks those few pumps in permanently. Wait, So after day 11, the cell can never upgrade its pumps, even if it suddenly realizes it made a mistake.
That is precisely what the data shows. The regulatory effects of calcium just vanish at day 11. Whatever pump density you have bolted down at that exact moment, well, that is the pump density you are stuck with for the rest of your life.
Which perfectly sets the stage for the absolute catastrophe of postnatal day 12.
Day 12 is roughly when the mouse actually begins to hear.
The big day.
Right. The ear canal opens and environmental sound mechanically drives the stereo cilia. But more importantly than just the sound, there is a massive physiological shift in the inner ear fluid. A powerful biological battery called the endolymphatic potential finally kicks in.
Let's explain what that battery actually does, because it changes everything for our little cell.
Well, the fluid surrounding these hair cells, it's called the endolymph, suddenly becomes highly charged. The endolymphatic potential creates a massive concentration of positively charged potassium and calcium ions right outside the cell.
So there's this immense electrochemical pressure just waiting for a channel to open.
Yes. It is a massive voltage that supercharges the driving force pushing calcium into the cells.
So the drought is officially over. The rainy season has arrived with a Category 5 hurricane.
And suddenly, those defective TMC1 channels, which were barely letting a trickle of calcium in just a week ago, are forced to let massive amounts of calcium rush into the cell, simply because of this new, intense electrical pressure pushing from the outside.
Oh no.
Yeah, but the cell is completely trapped. It has a permanently undersized population of PMCA2 pumps locked in concrete. They simply cannot bail the calcium out fast enough.
The house floods.
The backlog of calcium becomes highly toxic. Intracellular calcium spikes dramatically. This extreme calcium overload actually poisons the cell from the inside out. When the researchers looked closely with their electron microscopes at these older mutant cells after the flood, they didn't just see tired cells.
What did they find?
They found multivesicular bodies pooling inside them.
And multivesicular bodies are essentially the cellular equivalent of biohazard cleanup crews, right? I mean, they are a hallmark of autophagy, where the cell realizes it's fatally damaged and literally starts eating its own organelles.
Right.
And apoptosis, which is programmed cell death.
Exactly. The cell recognizes it is irreparably poisoned by the calcium toxicity, and it deliberately dismantles itself. The entire sensory machine is destroyed, leading to permanent irreversible deafness.
So what does this all mean? Because we aren't just telling a sad story about a microscopic cell making a bad architectural decision. This has massive real-world implications, especially for the booming field of gene therapy.
It really does.
In recent years, there's been incredible excitement about using tools like CRISPR to go in and fix these TMC1 deafness mutations in humans. But if I'm tracking the timeline correctly here, does this mean gene therapy is completely useless for these types of deafness if we perform the intervention too late?
This raises an important question, and unfortunately, the data points to a very grim reality if clinicians ignore the developmental timeline.
How so?
If a patient is born with a TMC1 mutation, their hair cells are going to spend their crucial early development in a severe calcium drought. They will permanently lock in a desperately low density of those PMCA2 bailing pumps.
Right.
If you wait until they are older, so after hearing has fully onset, after the endolymphatic potential has kicked in and the cells are already drowning in calcium and undergoing apoptosis, to go in and magically fix the TMC1 gene, it won't work.
Because even if you give them perfect, brand new TMC1 doors that open perfectly and let in the exact right amount of calcium, they still have the undersized drainage system permanently locked in concrete.
Exactly. You haven't fixed the pumps, just the doors.
So the cell will just flood even faster.
Precisely. Once those pumps are anchored by neuroplastin and that early developmental window closes, the cell's fate is largely sealed. You just cannot reverse the infrastructure. The key takeaway from this deep dive is that timing is absolutely everything. We must intervene with gene therapies during that very early developmental window before the low pump state is permanently hardwired into the cellular architecture.
It really reframes how we look at genetic disease. It's not just about having a broken part, it's about how the entire system adapts to that broken part,
right,
before we even realize what's happening.
Yeah, to summarize the core insight of this research, PMCA2 calcium pump density in our auditory cells is carefully calibrated by early calcium influx and then permanently locked into place by accessory proteins like neuroplastin.
A literal point of no return.
Right. A temporary calcium deficit early in development hardwires the sensory cell for failure, ultimately leading to fatal calcium overload and cell death, when the immense electrochemical demands of mature hearing begin.
What does this mean for the timing of genetic interventions in human deafness? Are we missing the critical window by waiting to treat until after symptoms appear?
It's the multi-million dollar question.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
The silence grows. Tiny gates swing open with a push and pull. But the calcium river don't arrive like it used to. So the cleanup crew can't do its job in full. Let's spark in the bundle, let's signal to send. Vesicles waiting where the bright tips bend. If the tide don't rise, the pump don't land. Hold on, hold on. Give it a chance again. Bring the pump back, bring the light back in. Keep that calcium moving, let the balance win. Don't let the power fade in the midnight spin. We're riding that rhythm on a thin, thin, thin. Early days of fragile turnover, running fast. Then they're gone too soon. Block the traffic, starve the fuse, and it slips away. And the cell starts hearing its own last tune. Neuroplastic comes late like a hand on the rail. 2 days behind, but it steadies the sail. If the anchor don't catch, the engine strain. Mitochondria crying in the dark again. Bring the pump back, bring the light